An Arizona house explodes early one morning into a massive fireball. Though firefighters get to the scene in less than 3 minutes, there was no way to save the family inside. Not because of the 20-foot-high flames, but because the family was already dead before the fire started. At least, most of the family was. The husband wasn't caught in the blast and has never been seen since. Today, we learn about the monster known as Robert Fisher.
Killing, missing, hidden. A podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome into another action-packed edition of Killing, Missing, Hidden, the podcast about bad things. I'm your charismatic and charming host, Brad. Former criminal defense attorney and self-proclaimed expert over all criminal matters. I am so happy you could join us today. We are now officially in the last month of this horrific year. Praise God. So please make yourself at home as I get today's episode ready to go. Kick your shoes off, grab some wine or whatever your favorite beverage is, get comfortable, and enjoy the soothing and relaxing tale of Familicide. Special thanks to listener Julia for suggesting this episode. All of y'all have been great about sending in suggestions, and to the fact that I can't keep up. Please keep them coming, but no, there won't be any prime shipping on them when we will deliver them. And also, thank you to the new members of our Facebook page. We're so happy to have you join our little cult. And you'll be happy to know we're much more of a let's not do anything and say we're being social sort of cult than the I'm a messenger of God who needs to have sex with everyone before we kill ourselves type. Man, well, before I change my mind on that philosophy, let's just get into the case. Robert William Fisher, the star of today's show, was born on April 13th, 1961 in Brooklyn, New York. His father was a banker and his mom took care of the house. Fisher had two sisters, who apparently he was close to. The family moved from Arizona as Fisher was a graduate of Saharo High School in Tucson, Arizona. Now, his parents didn't get along very well and divorced in 1976 when Fisher was only 15, and it was a very turbulent divorce. So much so that it left some serious mental scars on Fisher. He apparently was complaining about it well into his 40s, telling his coworkers that his life would have been so much different if his mom had not left the family. He also told his pastor that he would never get a divorce, as he did not want to put his family through the pain he experienced. It was so bad that he refused to ever take his kids to Disneyland, because that was the last place his parents had a fight before they divorced. Fisher's mother said in interviews that her ex-husband was very controlling and she was expected to be more of a yes-sir sort of wife, using her words. She was also concerned that Fisher was developing the similar attitude as his father's from early age, to such a degree that when he got married, she actually pulled aside his new bride and talked to her about what her concerns were. So, we're bouncing around a little bit. I'll try to keep this a little tighter. Fisher graduated from high school, like I said. He joined the Navy. And when he was in the Navy, he attempted to become a SEAL, but failed out of the program, and I think was made a firefighter. There's conflicting articles on some of this. Ultimately, he had to leave the Navy due to a back injury, but this really seemed to shape who he was as a person. He really wanted to be the macho guy in the crowd. He was an avid outdoorsman, and his friends would tell stories about him. You know, if he killed an elk, he'd go over there and smear the blood all over his face and body. And there was one time when they were camping out, and just out of the blue, he decided he wanted to swim across the lake, which is fine, but he did so with a Bowie knife in his teeth. So that's really the personality that we're dealing with here. And then, oddly to me, he became a nurse. And not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but it just strikes me as not the sort of manly job he would be attracted to. He seems like the sort that would want the title of something really macho sounding. I mean, he probably referred to his job by the duties he performed, like a technician or something. And he worked at the local Mayo Clinic Hospital, and that offers a degree of prestige that may have satisfied his macho needs, but I just still find it surprising that nursing is what he chose. So come 1987, Fisher decides he needs to settle down, and he married Mary Cooper. And they bought a house together in Scottsdale and started their little family. Now, Mary was considered to be a very kind woman, very close to her family, and deeply, deeply religious. She had told her friends growing up that her number one goal in life was to be a mother. And she achieved this goal twice while married to Fisher. They had a daughter named Brittany and a son named Bobby. And Mary, you know, was that sort of mom who was always volunteering to help with school events, was always just really involved in the kids' lives in a good way, in a very positive way. As far as the children, Brittany was the oldest, and she was considered to be both very intelligent and very athletic. Bobby was younger and considered his sister to be his best friend. He was a little more introverted and really enjoyed spending his time drawing. Now, from the outside looking in, this looked like an ideal family. But behind closed doors, Fisher and Mary really did not have a good marriage. Fisher was very controlling. Neighbors claimed that they could regularly hear them fighting, but what was odd is only Mary could be heard screaming. Fisher wouldn't raise his voice. So that kind of leads to the knee-jerk reaction of, well, what's her deal? But here's some examples that were reported, witnessed by neighbors, friends, and acquaintances of how controlling Fisher could be. For example, he required the whole house to be painted white and only white. He had to approve every single thing that was hung on the walls. And this really frustrated Mary because her mom was a bit of an artist and would send them stuff. And Fisher made her store it in a closet and then complain about how junky the closet was. He decided what the kids would wear every day, and he decided what they would eat for every single meal. His way of teaching his kids how to swim was to put them on a boat, go out into the middle of a lake, and then kick them off the boat. When his wife freaked out about it, he eventually pulled him up into the boat and said, that wasn't so bad, was it? He argued with Mary, or there was one time when Mary argued with him in front of a neighbor, and rather than arguing back, he just sprayed her with a hose until she left. There's apparently a videotape of Fisher playing with his kids, and Mary comes in with a video camera. And when Fisher saw this, he instantly changed attitude, ordered her to turn the dang thing off, and you could tell that he was a totally different person. Once as a prank, he snuck up, while out with his buddies, he snuck up on a family who was picnicking in the woods and shot his 9mm into the air to frighten them. He was openly embarrassed of his son not being interested in outdoor activities. So that's kind of what's going on with Fisher here. So don't get, you know, just because we only hear Mary shouting during their fights doesn't mean that Fisher's the calm one. And there were never any reports of what we would consider to be the traditional form of domestic violence or abuse, but there were plenty of attempts to humiliate his wife in an effort to maintain control. And friends would say it seemed like the only person he really liked in the family was his dog, Blue. He's oftentimes described as just having kind of this weird relationship with his family. All of his family. Like, friends described him as being a little bit awkward even around his kids. While they regularly and consistently attended church, they would get invited to lunch afterwards and Fisher would just never go. He never went to events with Mary's family or even his extended family. And he justified his decisions by saying he didn't want to get close to people just to have them leave him. Now, according to psychiatrists, you know, kids who experience their parents being divorced later in life or later in childhood often have feelings like this. But Fisher is an extreme example. Again, he did his best to portray himself as a family man and a man of faith. And many, many of his coworkers and acquaintances were shocked at Fisher's true face when it was revealed. Knowing what we know about Fisher's home life, it really isn't that surprising to learn that the marriage isn't going well. Fisher and Mary fought all the time, a lot of times about sex. A lot of times about how to raise the kids. I mean, they fought about how to decorate the house. They fought about money. On that last point, Mary even insisted on getting her own job so she and the kids could have, quote, a security fund. Neighbors who overheard the fights regularly heard Mary talk openly about divorce. But, as we mentioned, this was not an option for Fisher. Now, they did make efforts to salvage their marriage. They went to counseling with the senior pastor at their church, but it didn't go well. Apparently, Fisher wasn't the sort of person to really open up about his feelings, and he refused to accept responsibility for a lot of the problems in the marriage. After counseling didn't work, Fisher wrote a note to his wife confessing that he had had sex with a prostitute. Mary was obviously very furious and demanded that he give her some sort of space. So Fisher said, all right, I'll just go camping. His plan was literally to go camping for a month out in northern Arizona. But after only a few days, he returned, and he said he had spent a lot of time praying and meditating, and he promised Mary he would be the godly father and husband his family deserved. A few days later, he went on a hunting trip with a few buddies, and he commented that he would kill himself before he would go through a divorce. But the problems persisted. Fisher had another bit of adult fun with another woman, this time a masseuse, in December of 2009. I don't think this indiscretion was ever confessed to Mary. But he talked about it to coworkers because he was worried about Mary learning of it. And of course, the fighting continued, neighbors only hearing Mary's side. She would scream things like, you're worthless, I could have done better than you, and the ultimate threat, we should get a divorce. This fighting occurred late one night on April 9th, and that following morning, the neighborhood was rocked by the sound of a sudden explosion at the Fisher house. It occurred around 8:30 in the morning, just 6 or 7 hours after that fight ended. Firefighters rushed to the scene and attempted to contain the blaze when secondary explosions went off. The force of the initial explosion was so severe that it rattled houses up to a half mile or 800 meters away. Firefighters really struggled to contain the blaze, which had essentially destroyed the house by the time they arrived on the scene. Again, in less than 3 minutes. The cause of the fire was quickly discovered. Someone had pulled up and disconnected the house's natural gas line that led to the furnace. The house had also been covered in gasoline, and a single candle had been lit and left in the living room. Now, this is actually kind of a brilliant way to commit arson, because it gives a criminal so much time to escape. See, when natural gas is released into a closed environment, like a house, it rises. But being in a house, it can only go so high, right? So as more pulls in, it slowly begins to compress the oxygen and other air downwards. Once the natural gas hits a flame, there's an explosion, and if you've got any accelerant, a flash fire is created, and boom, total destruction. Now, it's a little more trickier than what I'm making it sound like, because there has to be a good ratio between the natural gas in the room and the amount of oxygen available to feed the fire. So if the natural gas hits the flame too quickly, or too late, you won't get an explosion like this. But according to arson investigators I've had the pleasure to talk to in my professional life, the sweet spot for this mixture is apparently right at the height of a kitchen table. So really having putting a candle on a table is the way to make this happen. In fact, one arson investigator told me the best way to burn down a house quickly is to let the natural gas into the house, you know, through the oven or what have you, whatever method. Then he said, get some water balloons and fill them with gasoline. And then take those balloons and kind of, you know, thumbtack them onto the ceiling or into the corners of the rooms that you want to make sure get destroyed. Then light your candle, place it on the kitchen table, and get out of Dodge. So when the gas hits the flame, you get that flash fire explosion throughout the house, which then burns up the balloon and causes the gasoline to fall. And that just causes a second wave of explosive flash fires. And it will burn everything down to the studs before the fire department can get the blaze under control. Of course, it will absolutely register as an arson to investigators, but it can destroy a lot of evidence really quickly. And really, if there's no evidence of a crime, and if you don't try to collect any insurance money, you won't ever be charged with arson in most jurisdictions because it's your house. You're allowed to burn it down if you want. You just can't do that to try to cover up a crime, and you can't try do it to try to, you know, defraud your homeowner's insurance company. Now, for anyone who thinks this sounds cool and wants to try it, I can't promise this actually works because I've never tried it. Plus, you know, despite my best efforts recently, I don't really want to turn this podcast into a creative ways to create new crimes and mischief. And let me say immediately, and you'll think I'm a hypocrite, that should your house ever burn or your car burn, and the insurance company sends you a very small check. Like, for example, if your house is worth $250,000, and they only send you a check for $5,000, don't cash it. It's a red flag. They think that you have committed arson. And by giving you the small amount of money, you have thus profited from the crime and can be charged with arson. They've minimized their risk. Obviously, they would rather lose $5,000 than $250,000. And just, they've set you up for a felony. And I've had several clients fall for this. You know, I won't say they're victims since they did kind of commit the arson, but you know what I mean. And I'll throw in the disclaimer again that as a criminal defense attorney, especially one who is friendly with cops and prosecutors, I tend to learn a lot of stuff that I shouldn't, and I probably shouldn't be passing it along, but the stories are fun, right? Okay, all right, let's drag this one back on track. So the investigators, after the fire's under control and they can get on the scene, they find three bodies in the rubble, and they were quickly identified as Mary and the two children, Brittany and Bobby. Now, Fisher was not in the house. Of course, one of the questions investigators had initially is, you know, natural gas gives off a pretty specific odor when it's leaking. And it's odd that nobody would notice that their house was showing up with rotten egg farts. But the answer to that question, sadly, is that the explosion was not what killed these three family members of Fisher's. Though the bodies were badly damaged in the explosion and the fire, investigators could still determine that they had died before the fire started. Mary had a bullet in her head, and obviously bullets don't go away in a fire. But the gruesome part here is all three bodies, including the two young children, had evidence that their throats had been slashed from ear to ear. I've seen a lot of bad stuff in my career, and I will never get used to folks who hurt kids like this. I just think it's totally monstrous. So where is Daddy Fisher in all this mess, huh? He ain't dead. So he's instantly suspect number one, as he should be. Oh, and the dog's missing too. So we can almost be certain that Fisher was not at the scene when the explosion happened. Police reviewed financial records to see if they could get any leads, and sure enough, they found that $280 had been withdrawn from a local ATM at 10:43 p.m. the night before the explosion. When the officers pulled security footage of the ATM, guess whose mug is staring right at the cops? Yep, it's Fisher. In his wife's car. And that explosion had given him at least a 10-hour head start on evading police, which is key here. Now, say what you will about him, but Fisher was smart. And he left no clues where he was headed. On April 14th, police issued a statewide bulletin asking for any law enforcement officer to arrest him on site. Yet no evidence of Fisher was found until April 20, and that was evidence that he left to be found. On that day, Mary's car was found, along with Fisher's dog, good old Blue, in the Tonto National Forest, which is about 100 miles north of Scottsdale. Fisher also, and I'm serious, Fisher pooped next to the car. Every article I read mentioned this weird fact, so how could I not? And why do you poop next to the car when you're in a place surrounded by trees? This dude was a weirdo. I'm guessing that was some sort of middle finger to law enforcement. I don't know. Interestingly, Fisher's last camping trip before he went all psycho killer was, guess where? The Tonto National Forest. Might he have been scouting out the best places to hide before committing these horrific murders? Do we have some evidence of premeditation here? Fisher again made a shrewd decision at this point. This area where his vehicle is, or his wife's vehicle was found, is riddled with caves that Fisher could have hidden in. And police were only able to safely search one of the caves out of the dozens that were close to the vehicle, much less those further into the park. Expert cavers have said that the caves would be the perfect hiding spot if Fisher was smart and knew his way around spelunking. These caves, of course, present a risk of suffocating, or if there's a surprise rainstorm, could just wash them away. And, you know, the ever-present threat of being lost. Because police were unable to safely search hardly any of the caves, several expert spelunkers actually volunteered and searched many of the caves around the area on their own for years, but found nothing. Now, in addition, less than a mile away from where this vehicle was parked and Fisher's poo was found is the Fort Apache Indian Reserve. Now, tribal lands are considered sovereign under federal law. So local police can't go on to tribal lands to do any sort of investigation whatsoever. Their police powers end where that reservation begins. So not only could Fisher have hidden in a cave, he could have easily taken the short hike and been out of police jurisdiction. And I found at least one article that suggests the tribal police were never asked to aid in this search. And if that's true, Fisher easily could have hung out there for a while, not really raising eyebrows other than, you know, a white dude appearing out of nowhere hiding in the woods. Now, there were a few sightings of Fisher since the murders were committed, but the only real witness during the first few years were a couple who claimed to have seen a man who looked like Fisher before the police found the abandoned car. The sighting occurred on a nearby road where the husband and wife were driving, and the wife saw this man walking down the road, and she said, "That looks like the Robert Fisher fella." And the husband, being a husband, didn't do anything because he didn't want to get involved in it. And I say this as a husband, but don't we always kind of come across as doofuses in these situations? But regardless, neither one of them reported the sighting to anyone until news media outlets started reporting that the car had been found in that area that they were just in. So the next sighting of note doesn't occur for about 3 years, and it occurs in Canada in 2004. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police detained a man in Vancouver who looked just like Fisher. And not only that, Fisher had a gold crown on one of his teeth. This dude was missing that tooth. Further, Fisher had some pretty significant surgical scarring from when he injured his back in the Navy. This dude, surgical scars on his back. So the Canadian police there take his fingerprints and they don't match Fisher's, but the dude looks so much like Fisher and he's got so many of the distinguishing characteristics that they refused to let him go until a member of the Arizona State Police could come and see him. They did, and they, you know, ultimately determined it wasn't Fisher. They found that his fingerprints hadn't been altered with in any way. And they decided to finally let the poor man go, who had been held in custody for about a week. And here's your non sequitur of the day. Why does this remind me of the Royal Canadian Kilted Yaksman from Ren and Stimpy? Do y'all remember that? Are you old enough for that? If you're not, you should look it up. It was a great episode. And the anthem was just so moving. Do you remember it? Our country reeks of trees. Our yaks are really large. And they smell like rotting beef carcasses. And we have to clean up after them. And our saddle sores are the best. Please tell me, like, some of y'all know this, right? All right, back on track again. So other than these two sightings, Fisher has been a ghost. He's currently listed on the FBI's Most Wanted list, as well as America's Most Wanted Dirty Dozen list, where he holds a coveted top spot. It's a list I had actually never heard of before researching this episode. Now, there have been lots of unconfirmed sightings. Neighbors claim that they've seen someone who looks exactly like Fisher drive through the neighborhood to look at the old house, as if he's reminiscing about these murders he committed. In October of 2014, police got a tip and raided a house where Fisher was allegedly living in Colorado. He wasn't there, but there were two men with outstanding warrants, so they got something out of that fishing expedition. One source I found claimed that the Arizona police had received over 300 unconfirmed sightings of Fisher during the years. And America's Most Wanted, I think, has featured Fisher twice. And after one of the episodes, received a call from a man that the producers are convinced was Fisher. And the call came from Chester, Virginia. The FBI continues to release updated age-progressed images of Fisher in hopes of finding him. They publish that he's known to have ties to New Mexico and Florida, in addition to Arizona. As a description, because of his back surgery, he has an unusual walk, very erect, his chest puffed out. He is an avid Copenhagen chewing tobacco user. There's a lot of thought that he is living off the land and likes to stay in the woods as much as possible so they won't get caught. But there's a strong minority who believe that he committed suicide because he didn't have the resources with him to carry on this long. And it seemed like his goal in life, his unusually strong goal in life, was just to have a normal family. So that kind of puts us at the end of this tale. I don't know that there's much room for analysis here. We know what happened. We know who did it. We just don't know where he is. And I know better than most that everybody's presumed innocent and all that, but this dude is dangerous, and I have no doubts that he killed his family. Again, he's smart. He strikes me as the sort that could get away with this. But if he were to be caught, it would be because he got overconfident. He strikes me as a bit of a know-it-all. He wants to be the guy in the conversation that's the smartest in the room, you know. Part of that machismo image he needs to project. Now, this dude's going to turn 60 next year, if I did my math correctly. And I don't know many 60-year-olds who have been through significant back surgery that require daily pain meds who would be willing to stay in the woods for this long. So, if he's alive, and I do think that's a big if, he's changed his name and taken up residence in a town far away from the Southwest, probably far away from anywhere he has connections. And he probably works some sort of menial job in a hospital or a medical clinic due to his nursing training. One fact that stands out really odd to me that I didn't see much discussion on is, why was his dog left with the vehicle? That's his best friend. But that does suggest that he did not walk away from the scene, because the dog would have followed. I'm thinking that he hitchhiked and got in the car, and the dog followed to that point, then went back to Mary's vehicle, hoping Fisher would come back. Or somebody was there waiting to meet him. He had lots of hunting buddies, lots of outdoors buddies. And in fact, when he went on that last hunting trip, he did not go there alone. He went there with at least one other friend. As far as the suicide threat, you know, I'm hoping that's what happened. I hope the scumbag's dead. I mean, he killed his family in a brutal fashion and ran like a coward. So it wouldn't be shocking to me at all to learn that he took the coward's way out. But looking at the facts, most people who kill their families and then decide to kill themselves do so at the scene of the crime. So it's unusual for him not to be found with the fire. But again, this is a weird dude. He may define the stereotypes and he may be scratching out a living like the cockroach he is. Who knows? I want to say that too, as always, you can find my show notes at our website, kmhpodcast.com. But for this being such a huge case, there are a ton of inconsistencies in the reports I read. So some of the details I presented may be off. I was oftentimes kind of forced to pick between details. But fortunately, all the inconsistencies appear to be in background information and other minor details. I think the meat of this story is solid. But to the extent there are any errors, I apologize. And we are ending this episode here. If by chance you know anything about this dude, please contact the FBI. This is the type of guy that needs to be taken off the streets. Thank you again to Julia for suggesting this episode. It was a really interesting one to me. And I hope all of y'all found my regurgitation of it to be good as well. That's going to take us to our palate cleanser, of course. Mr. Eli has come up with another gem. Here we go. Have you been to that new restaurant called Karma? They don't have any menus. They just serve you what you deserve. I will pause for some applause at this time because I think that one's particularly good. Okay, remember we're doing a listener story episode soon. Please remember to send in your best stories. Any personal experience you've had that could be classified as being true crime-ish or paranormal-ish. You can even make it fictional if you want, just so long as you do a good enough job that it's obvious it ain't true. Wait, no. So long as you do a good enough job so that it's not obvious that it's not true. I got confused with double negatives there. I'll need those stories by December 11th. It's going to be part of our 50th episode spectacular, and I want to make it all about you, our dear listener. So please don't disappoint me. And that brings us to the end of our journey today. Please make sure to share our podcast with your friends. You know what? I had this idea and I just got to share it. Let's pull a George Costanza if you're a Seinfeld fan, okay? Since it's the gift-giving season, give all your friends a gift certificate for one free listen to our podcast. Okay, everybody wins. You give a gift that you don't have to spend any money on. I get extra listeners, and they learn about our Kick Butt podcast. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Oh, I don't understand why I'm not a millionaire. Okay, well, thank you for tuning in. I know that you've got a ton of different ways to keep yourself distracted, and the fact that you choose us and keep choosing us is really an honor. Please go out and do something kind for yourself today, and please don't murder your family. set any houses on fire. I would kind of feel bad if the number of arsons go up after this episode comes out. But remember, we love you all. We can't wait to see you again. And with that, I will say, Brett out.
Thank you for listening to Killin', Missin', Hidden. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and share. Questions? Email us at info@kmhpodcast.com.